July 14th, 2018. Welcome to part two of this week's Weekly Assertion, a show so long you might say so long before my voice is gone. I'm your host, Blue, and this is my final segment, so I have decided to double down on what I do best, which is take forever to say anything at all, splain until your brains feel no more pain. Moving on. When we think about thinking, we may believe that we are the ones driving the bus, when in fact, it's more like we're along for the ride. For those magical darlings out there, obsessed with audience reification and telepathy, this P.T. Barnum bit is for you. Commodification is the transformation of goods, services, ideas, and people into commodities or objects of trade. When we speak in terms of commodity markets, this may bring to mind something as mundane as blueberries. But when we focus instead on the word ideas, we begin to get a different picture. Thought commodities are rarely discussed as such. But in our tiny circles, they are perhaps the most frequently traded goods. A thought commodity can be many things, and among them are ideologies, books, even the private label ones that we don't write ourselves, frameworks, positions, and philosophies. When the thought commodity is packaged up all nice and pretty, our favorite golden hammer tends to be an emphasis on the role of the people against the elite. A morally good force against those who are perceived as corrupt. This kind of false dichotomy is the language of marketers, and there's a sucker born every minute. In the context of Marxism, vanguardism is a strategy whereby the most class-conscious and politically advanced sections of the proletariat or working class, described as the revolutionary vanguard, form organizations in order to draw larger sections of the working class towards revolutionary politics and serve as manifestations of proletarian political power against its so-called class enemies. Karl's real talent was his ability to take complicated issues, oversimplify them for mass consumption, package them up in a false dichotomy, control the narrative through the development of tunnel vision, team sports, and telepathically teleport this blue thought commodity through both time and space. If this false dichotomy was food, many anarchists would be filled to the brim at the all-you-can-eat buffet. E.F. Schumacher asserted, Marx, by seeking a scapegoat in the bourgeoisie, had replaced personal responsibility with a hatred for others. And as we discussed last week, seeming is much easier than being. And being alone seems much worse than being a good team player. Bakunin criticized Marx for his authoritarian bent, but I would assert that he was more interested in changing the color of Marx's blue Kool-Aid rather than throwing the poison in the trash. Bakunin described his aim as the establishment of a government with unlimited dictatorial power, in which all will be subjugated to a single dictatorial authority through three secret societies based on strict hierarchy and unconditional discipline. In 1866, Bakunin abandoned the idea of state or centralized authority, and his ideas of what a secret society should be changed accordingly, saying, "We are bitter foes of all official power, even if it were ultra-revolutionary power. We are enemies of all publicly acknowledged dictatorship. We are social revolutionary anarchists. But you will ask, if we are anarchists, by what right do we wish to, and by what method can we influence the people? An invisible force, recognized by no one, imposed by no one, through which the collective dictatorship of our organization will be all the mightier. The more it remains invisible and unacknowledged, the more it remains without any official legality and significance. This concept is also made plain in a letter Bakunin penned during the turmoil surrounding the Paris Commune. He said, "We must awaken and foment all the dynamic passions of the people. We must bring forth anarchy, and in the midst of the popular tempest, we must be the invisible pilots guiding the revolution, not by any kind of overt power, but by the collective dictatorship of all our allies. A dictatorship without tricks, without official titles, without official rights, and therefore all the more powerful." According to political scientist Michael Birkin, not to be confused with Bakunin, conspiracy theories evolve to incorporate whatever evidence exists against them, so that they become a closed system that is unfalsifiable, and therefore a matter of faith rather than proof. So it would appear that perhaps there was not much of a commodity shift so much as a packaging one. Both Marx and Bakunin seem super interested in waking the sheeple, but perhaps they were more interested in slinging Kool-Aid. One simply wanted to distribute their commodity overtly, while the other wished to do so virally. This strategy of groupless groupthink is effective, and we have seen it executed in ways ranging from the puppeteering practices of the media to the decadence of identity politics, snitch jacketing, and the true Scotsman fallacies of attempting to define anarchism. This kind of blue homogenization by way of social collateral gives a disgusting tone to harmony on its intellectual race to the bottom, so that it may have greater mass appeal. You can call it whatever color you want, but I know blue when I taste it. An idealist is a person who helps other people to be prosperous, said Henry Ford. And this guy knew how commodities worked. A customer can have a car painted any color, so long as it's black. The blue wall of silence is a term used in the United States to denote the informal rule among police officers to abstain from reporting on a colleague's errors, misconducts, or crimes. The thin blue line is also a phrase used by law enforcement, referring to the position of law enforcement in society as a bulwark between order and anarchy. Whether your uniform is black or blue, you're not as covert as you might think. Curious George Brigade asserted, "Inject the crucial element of chaos into our demonstrations. Police are repulsed by chaos, and as are all hierarchical organizations. We must be like living water. We need strategies more flexible than rigid organizations, such as critical thinking, good conversation, rejection of oversimplification, and killing that cop in our head." A passage from Society of the Spectacle reads, "The strength and the weakness of the real anarchist struggle resides in its viewing the goal of proletarian revolution as immediately present. From the historical thought of modern class struggles, collectivist anarchism retains only the conclusion, and its exclusive insistence on this conclusion is accomplished by deliberate contempt for method. Thus, its critique of the political struggle has remained abstract. The abstraction of political language, according to George Orwell, is designed to make lies sound truthful, murder respectable, and to give an appearance of solidity to pure wind. Michael Sheldon asserted that Orwell believed that the language used was necessarily vague or meaningless because it was intended to hide the truth rather than express it. This unclear prose was a contagion, which had spread to those who did not intend to hide the truth, and it concealed a writer's thoughts from himself and others. Bakunin wrote in 1873, "During the past 9 years, more ideas have been developed within the International than would be needed to save the world if ideas alone could save it. And I challenge anyone to invent a new one. It is no longer the time for ideas, but for facts and acts." To which Spectacle Guy replies, "There is no doubt that this conception retains an element of the historical thought of the proletariat, the certainty that ideas must become practice, but it leaves the historical terrain by assuming that the adequate forms for this passage to practice have already been found and will never change. Static, rigid ideology is the packaged product of the marketer. Rather than oversimplified perfection, practice and method are the behaviors of those of us living in the wild." Dave Neal asserted that his main objection to ideological anarchism is that it depends not on free thinking and direct action, but on obedience, passivity, and conformity to an externality, either a manifesto, platform, or other mechanism of control. Further, it focuses on a top-down, centralized organization as a means of bringing anarchism from the center outward. In order to sell someone your thought commodity, you must first grasp people's attention, and making your stuff free is what gets it. That's what draws people in. Once you have an audience, you can chat with them, figure out what they want, and sell them just that. Savvy marketers, though, introduced their customers to desires they didn't know they had. We see this in the street, with banners flown, hundreds or thousands marching, and interrupting the routines of the audience around them. From television commercials, to door-to-door sales, to pop-up advertisements, marketers have this shit on lock. Yet, faced with living water, competing on unknown terrain, these social incels feel entitled to attention and will attack anyone who they deem to be stealing their market share. They will troll, threaten, dox, discredit, attack, snitch jacket, distribute misinformation, and so commit so many other acts of espionage in order to maintain their sales goals. The one thing they will never do, however, is compete with living water, because without form, there is no position to attack. And so the extinction bursts of the marketers are many and great. What these obsolete marketers do not yet understand is that attention, as they see it, cannot be stolen, only given. in today's world of mass marketing, people are overloaded with advertisements that compete for their limited time and attention span. We come into contact with nearly 3,000 per day. With that kind of overflow, our response is to disregard them, tune them out, and refuse to respond. It's not that the marketer's attention is being stolen. It's that free-thinking humans are tired of marketing. The circled A is a top-down perspective peering into a vessel, the kind of vessel that might hold water. Critical thinkers would rather that vessel remain empty, but instead it is filled with a thought commodity of some marketer's version of anarchism. What marketers used to do is make average products for average people. That's what mass marketing is, says Seth Godin. He goes on to say these obsolete marketers would smooth out the edges, go for the center. But in a world where the TV industrial complex is broken, I don't think that's a strategy we want to use anymore, he says. I think the strategy we want to use is to not market to the masses because they're really good at ignoring you. But market instead to these first segments because they care. These are the people who are obsessed. The segments Seth is talking about lie on what is called the diffusion of innovation. In 1995, Murray Bookchin published a book titled Social Anarchism or Lifestyle Anarchism, An Unbridgeable Chasm. Bookchin sets his social anarchism in opposition to individualist, primitivist, and postmodern forms of anarchism, and to me sounds an awful lot like a false dichotomy. Murray probably skipped the 1991 book called Crossing the Chasm by Jeffrey Moore, which focuses on a theory called the diffusion of innovation, which was originally published in 1962 by communication studies professor Everett Rogers. Rogers proposes that four main elements influence the spread of a new idea: the innovation itself, communication channels, time, and a social system. The innovation must be widely adopted in order to sustain itself out in the wild. And within the rate of adoption, there is a point at which innovation reaches critical mass, or what some would call a tipping point. This tipping point is what mass marketers are obsessed with, and what Marx would have called the proletarian revolution, if only the damn sheeple would drink his Kool-Aid, wake up, and free themselves from their oppressors. Dave Neal asserts once more on the mindset of the marketer, stating, "One thing ideologues of all stripes share is a negative view of human nature. They see us all as basically bad and in need of improvement, achieved by a period of indoctrination, naturally, which they offer. Further, ideologues hold themselves exempt from this principle of negative human nature. That is, they are okay, but the rest of the world is fucked." But the mass marketers do not understand the way of things. The diffusion of innovation breaks down the rate of adoption for an innovation into five categories on a bell curve: innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. I would suggest that for our purposes, there is also a brackish individual existing as a fusion of innovation and early adopter. The earlier segments that Seth was talking about earlier, the obsessed ones, are at the beginning, and therefore least populated portion of the curve. The innovators and early adopters. And in the middle, the largest population are the early and late majority, the so-called sheeple, obsolete marketers say they're trying to wake up. Innovators are willing to take risks. They have the highest social status among those on the curve. They have high financial liquidity, are social, and have closest contact with other innovators. Their risk tolerance allows them to adopt technologies that may ultimately fail, and their financial resources help to absorb these failures. In the world of thought commodities, one might interpret financial liquidity as social capital. Liquidity would then be defined as those whom have the long lineage of getting shit done and a large social network of people who value and trust them. It could also be someone who just gives absolutely no fucks, doesn't feel like they have anything to lose, is unafraid of failure, and acquires gratification internally rather than externally. This internal gratification allows them to see value where others see none yet. Early adopters have the highest degree of opinion leadership among all of the categories, because sometimes innovators can come across as a little wingnutty, or so obsessed they can't really communicate outside of their focus. Early adopters have a higher social status, financial liquidity, advanced education, and are more socially forward than the early majority. They are more discreet in adoption choices than innovators, and they are extremely strategic in what they choose to adopt in order to maintain their influence. If the rumors are true that they're repping an excessive amount of failures or stupid ideas, then they will lose their influence, and being an influencer for the early adopter is all that they have and care about. I would posit that within the context of this letter, early adopters are the most likely to be thought commodity marketers. They could be confused as leaders, but in fact rely on innovators for their inventions and innovations. Without the innovator's eye for value, they would have nothing to take possession of and to market. They do recognize the value of speaking across the chasm, however, and leverage this by possessing access to it as a gatekeeper. It is this possessiveness that separates them from the brackish. Naturally, there are early adopters who are not marketers in the context of this letter. And this kind of living water recognizes only serendipity, the wild, chaos, and anarchy. This brackish category recognizes that the only constant is that nothing is constant, and that there is no ultimate truth to be packaged and sold, only more precise questions. The brackish ready themselves strategically for opportunity whenever it may appear, anticipating the unexpected and handling it with the grace of practice. They perceive quality of life in terms of liberty and avoid becoming entrapped. Snares like groupthink, ideology, perfectionism, prefiguration, and protest are often evaded. The brackish seeks growth above all. They are highly educated, either formally or self-taught. Due to the nature that they are a mixture of innovator and early adopter, they are the most likely to participate in open source